You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. Coming up, the 26th annual Wisconsin Space Conference is taking place later this week. We hear from the woman who headed NASA's mission to Pluto.
First, Sue Riesling, just retired as UW-Madison police chief, a post that she had held for 25 years. That quarter century has been one in which politics and public perceptions involving law enforcement have changed a lot.
Sue Riesling joins us now in the studio to look back on those years as UW-Madison police chief and what lessons she learned. Sue, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
So you became police chief at UW-Madison in 1991. How common was it for a woman to be heading a police department at that time?
It wasn't very common at all. We did kind of a quick poll, and we found that there were about 60-some police chiefs that were women across the United States. Now, put into proportion, the number of police agencies in the United States is around 18,000. So we were a small wee bit fraction at the time. We're a little bit better now. But that led me to help form the National Association of Women Law Enforcement Executives, which I formed in 1996, which is now 20 years old. And it has about 600 members. So, and that's not all women police chiefs. That's, but that's a pretty good portion of the women police chiefs in the country.
So when you arrived in 1991, what were some of the biggest challenges that you saw when you took your post?
Well, my predecessor, Ralph Hansen, had been police chief for 26 years, and so I wanted to, make it through a year. Since he made it through 26, I was hoping I'd make it through one, which I did. But I think at the time what we were facing was a sense of disconnect a little bit with the campus. We wanted to institute community-oriented policing. We wanted to do more problem-solving policing. And we also wanted to kind of update and revamp the way we did business, the policy manuals, the procedures, the training, you know, those kinds of things. It was a nice department. When I got here in 1991, I was telling folks the other day that the department had exactly 8 computers. And they were all Wangs. And you have to be a certain age to appreciate that. And so now, you know, with computers literally in everybody's hands and every car, and they're just everywhere today. But back then, I had to actually computerize the police department. And we were the first ones to put computers in the cars in 1992 of anyone in the state. And, you know, we just kept going with technology since then. So it was mainly kind of we needed to refresh the organization in the early 90s.
And one of the things that the UW Police Department also led the way on was body cameras, being one of the first to utilize those. What made you decide that that was an important addition?
Well, we have had cameras in the cars since the 90s. And the body cameras to me, you know, at first I wasn't sold on them when they first came out about 7-8 years ago. I just thought they would be like way intrusive. But as time has gone on and the technology has gotten better, the storage has gotten better, it just makes sense to me that if you can record it, it just ends an awful lot of debate about what happened or how it happened or who said what to who when. It just is just there for people to review and to see. And I have always found that whether it's recording 911 calls, whether it's recording traffic stops, whether it's now recording interactions of police with the community, that the police are found to have behaved very well in more situations than they're ever found to behave inappropriately. And I just think it lends credibility.
We're talking with Sue Riesling, who recently retired as UW-Madison police chief after 25 years in that position. Campus shootings have sadly become much more frequent events during the time that you've been at UW. How has that changed the role of campus police?
Well, you know, the first real shooting on a campus was 50 years ago, just last week,
right?
The shooting at in Austin in the Texas Tower. But they have become just more prevalent in every part of our life, whether it starts at the post office or the mall or the movie theater or on universities. And actually, the university police, we had gone to rifles. We were one of the first in the area to go to rifles back in the mid-90s, and then other departments have followed suit. But we did that, you know, in response really to Columbine and the shootings in high schools, because we figured if it was in high schools, it would be coming to college. And sure enough, you know, in the next decade, it obviously did. So that has changed things on campuses from not only the response of rifles and ballistic blankets and ballistic shields and ballistic helmets and ballistic vests, which everybody says, oh, that's militarizing the police. The reality of that is the police are just responding to the type of weapons being used against the police now and against society. But also, we have a very robust threat assessment program at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, full-time threat director, who was a former FBI agent and spent 25 years with the FBI, and now he runs the threat assessment process for the University of Wisconsin-Madison Police Department. And there's a big threat team, and then there's a behavioral intervention team. So they do a lot of work to prevent the problem from happening.
Another problem on college campuses is sexual assault and rape. As a UW-Madison police chief, how did you try to address the many issues that go into those crimes?
There's just so many. It's really hard to gauge the progress sometimes. Over my 34 years in the profession, we've been talking about this problem. And finally, a couple of years ago, I decided to change the way we spoke about it, and we were going to talk more about the assailant instead of the survivor. We always had a lot of, you know, good information for the survivor and all the different things that he or she could have done differently, and all of that for, you know, 30 years. But the last couple of years, we really started to focus on who is actually perpetrating this in a prevention mode of talking to young men very directly about too much alcohol, no means no, you know your limits, understand what she wants, that she's actually a human being. You know, I think sometimes there's something about peer pressure or something with young men that it just gets out of control. So we've tried to do a number of things, but I have to say, in my 34 years, serving the victim has and the survivor has been where we've made a lot of gains. Really preventing it, we unfortunately haven't made a tremendous amount of gains.
And you are not leaving the field. You've been in the field for 34 years, 25 here at UW-Madison. You are now the executive director of the International Association of Campus Law Enforcement Administrators. You said before the interview, basically, campus police chiefs. How different or similar are the issues that campus police forces face around the world?
Well, it's kind of been fascinating to just get acquainted with policing in different parts of the world. I'd had a 5-year stint with the International Association of Chiefs of Police, which are all different types of police chiefs throughout the world, and that was really an interesting thing. They were in 117 countries, so I got started there. But IACLEA has got members in 10 countries, and I'm trying to sort it all out as my week starts here. But basically, we face a lot of the same issues regardless of the country. There are strong cultural differences between, you know, China and South Africa and the Caribbean and Europe where we are. But there are definite similarities and there's definite cultural differences. So I'm just trying to sort my way through that. But honestly, taking on alcohol, taking on sexual assault, taking on these shootings, taking on demonstrations, which is something that a lot of the campuses have been really working hard on, especially in South Africa and the African nations. Those topics are the same worldwide. Everybody has a little bit of a different twist. They don't quite police in China the way we police, obviously, in the United States. So it's been interesting to listen to their perspective.
And in the last 30 seconds we have or so, I read that you had wanted to be a police officer since you were a little girl. Would you encourage young people today to consider a career in law enforcement?
I would. I know that it's tough right now. People feel a great deal of tension between the police and the community. You know, out of this tension will just come production, and things will move forward. It always has, and I think it always will. And I would certainly encourage a young person to think about law enforcement.
Well, Sue, thanks so much for joining us, and best of luck in your future endeavors.
Thanks for having me. It's been a pleasure.
Sue Reisling recently retired as UW-Madison Police Chief after 25 years on the force. She has just become the Executive Director of the International Association of Campus Law Enforcement Administrators.
Space exploration enthusiasts were thrilled to hear this announcement on July 13th, 2015.
It sounds like science fiction, but it's not. Tomorrow morning, a United States spacecraft will fly by the Pluto system and make history. I think this is a great example of a great society and a great nation and what great nations do. And I have to tell you, the data that we're going to produce, in fact, the data that we're already producing, is a gift for the ages.
July 14th, 2015 was a very exciting day when NASA's New Horizons spacecraft made a very close, in galactic terms, flyby of Pluto. Many years of hard work and, yes, a little bit of luck went into the mission that is producing surprising and useful data about a planet that not much research has been done about.
Alice Bowman works for the Johns Hopkins Applied Physics Laboratory in Laurel, Maryland, where she's the Mission Operations Manager, she's called Mom there, for NASA's New Horizons mission to Pluto. She's the featured evening keynote at the 26th Annual Wisconsin Space Conference at UW-Superior this Thursday, August 11th. Alice, welcome to Central Time.
Oh, so happy to be here.
Well, a lot of us in the media and in the public got to join this New Horizons story at the really fun part when the news came out last summer. But this was a long time in the making. Can you talk about how long a project it was to get this craft past Pluto?
Well, it started with the development of the spacecraft. Well, actually, the winning of the proposal being funded by NASA. And that happened in 2002. And we took 4 years to develop and build and test that spacecraft, and we launched January 19th, 2006. And then it was a very long transit to the Pluto system, which is very far away. It's about 3 billion miles away from Earth.
And why Pluto in particular? I understand we knew surprisingly little about Pluto before this.
We did. Our best images were collected with the Hubble Space Telescope, and scientists have been poring over those images for years, and it shows a very blotchy picture of Pluto, but it's amazing what the scientists could glean from that. So from those tantalizing pictures, scientists knew that it was going to be a very interesting system to visit. And it's, you know, the last of our classical planets that had not yet been explored.
And when we actually started getting these images, it sounds like it exceeded everyone's hopes and expectations for the stuff we saw there.
Oh, my gosh. What an amazing place. It is filled with ice, mountains, methane frost, smooth plains where this ice lands, and floating icebergs, craters. I mean, you name it, Pluto has it. It's an amazing world, and I think we were all so very much surprised at the diversity that we were seeing. We even see atmosphere at Pluto, different levels of atmosphere. It has a blue sky. It's amazing.
I want to talk about the journey a little more. I was reading about some of the problems encountered, and I thought this morning I had a computer problem, and I walked down the hall and got the IT person. For New Horizons, the IT person was years away back on Earth, and the distance getting longer every time. Talk about some of the computer problems and how they got solved.
Well, many times people think, well, once you launch a spacecraft from Earth, that's it. Whatever you've got on board that spacecraft is what you're going to arrive at your destination with. That's not quite true. We can update software on our spacecraft, and when we encounter problems that we can trace to a software problem, then we can uplink those ones and zeros to the computer memory on board that spacecraft, even though it may be billions of miles away, and fix those little glitches, we like to call them. It requires a huge team effort, and you know, after years of working with many of the very same people who launched the spacecraft. We have a pretty tight team, good communication, and I think that was one of the very best things that enabled us to succeed in this mission, that teamwork.
You mentioned those ones and zeros. I understand a problem I don't think we have often on Earth. Cosmic radiation could change those ones and zeros and actually foil some of what the computer was doing?
Yes, that is true. Computer memory is basically the ones and zeros in different parts of the memory. And sometimes those cosmic rays can come in and switch that one to a zero, and then we will experience a fault on board the spacecraft. It takes more than one of these. We call them bit flips. It takes more than one of those to trigger a fault condition. And our main computer was, even though we had protected against it, it is susceptible to some of these radiation, we call them radiation hits that we get. And occasionally we'll get a number of these in to the main computer, and it will cause the computer to reboot, just like you would see on your computer screen when you sometimes it goes blue. You get that blue screen of death, and you hit that reset button, and things come back to normal.
Well, you made it successful. You got it there to Pluto. The mission was a success. I understand, though, New Horizons isn't done. Now, there's a lot of really interesting stuff past Pluto, and New Horizons is going to help investigate that. Is that right?
Yes. We were awarded or funded mission extension by NASA in July, and so we are now planning for our next target, which is 2014 MU69. We will have closest approach with that object, which is about 23 miles in diameter, so a very small object, and that closest approach will be January 1st, 2019.
We're talking to Alice Bowman, the New Horizons Mission Operations Manager. She's speaking in Superior at the 26th Annual Wisconsin Space Conference on Thursday. Alice, let's go back a little earlier in the story. When did you get interested in space exploration, and what got you interested in it?
Oh, my gosh. I've been interested in space exploration from a very early age. When I was growing up in the 60s and 70s, we had the space race. We were trying to get a man on the moon. And that started in the early years of the 1960s. I was 3 or 4 years old, and on the TV, almost every single day you could get updates on what those astronauts were doing, how the space program was going, the Gemini, Mercury, Apollo programs. And so, as a kid, that's what I wanted to do. That was exciting. That was something new. That was an adventure that was just there for the taking, basically. And I kept that interest as I went through my high school and college years.
There was a time, that time you're talking about, I think, when women in science and the space program were not non-existent, but rare. But the New Horizons team, you obviously played this central, crucial role, a lot of other women working on this team. How have things changed? Why have things changed now that we're seeing more women represented in space science?
Well, obviously, I wasn't part of those teams in the early phases of the the space program, but I can tell you, I can say now that it's the norm to see women part of these teams. New Horizons, they said that we have the highest percentage of women on a NASA program thus far, and that's at about 25%. And that made me think a little bit to our mission operations team, which is the team that I manage. And I started counting up to see how many women we had on our team. And we're just under 50% women. So that's a really good balance. When I was putting this team together, I was looking for diversity of thought and experience, because I felt that was the key to innovative problem solving, which I knew we were going to encounter, problems that no mission had encountered before. So I think it's a strength of our team.
I think a lot of people in science share your story, people who were young girls or boys at the time of the moon landings and the space program back in those days, and then inspired to go into a science of any sort. Do you see, do you hope that projects like the one you're working on are inspiring the next generation of scientists?
I certainly do, and I can tell you that when I go and speak places, just the subject of space exploration is one of those things that people just love hearing about. You don't even have to be a scientist to enjoy hearing about those things. And after these presentations and talks, I'll always have questions from young people, and I think that's certainly telling of their interest and the excitement they share in space exploration.
Give us a preview of your keynote in Superior on Thursday. What are you going to be focusing on?
Well, I am going to be talking about the mission, of course, and our journey to the Pluto system and some of the things that we had to overcome as a team and how we did it, things that we planned for or that thankfully didn't come to fruition, but we had a plan in place in case those things happened. And so I'll just be giving a little bit of a background insight into those types of things.
Before we let you go, what is the next currently unanswered question that you're hoping we're on the verge of getting an answer to?
Oh, my goodness. I guess there's a lot of questions.
I bet.
I've just been intrigued with the LIGO experiments that have been going on and the detection of gravity waves. I think there are so many really neat questions out there, more than enough to keep our younger generation interested in science for a very long time.
Well, Alice, thank you so much for joining us, and enjoy your visit to Wisconsin.
Thank you very much for having me.
Alice Bowman is the Mission Operations Manager for NASA's New Horizons mission, which last summer made the first visit to Pluto and brought back some really interesting images and data. All that's still being crunched right now. She is the featured evening keynote speaker at the 26th Annual Wisconsin Space Conference at UW-Superior this Thursday, August 11th. You can find event information on the Central Time Facebook page. Today is the Wisconsin August primary, and the general election is just a few months from now on November 8th. Both of those elections, no surprise, are on Tuesdays.
But many people, including our next guest, have advocated for Congress to either make the day a national holiday or move the election to a day that's more convenient and easier for people to head to the polls.
Joining us now is Bo Tremeteer. He's the editor-in-chief of the Northwestern Law Review. He's also involved with the Election Rave campaign. He wrote an editorial about Election Day that we have linked on the Central Time Facebook page. Bo, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Well, how big an obstacle to voting do you think our Tuesday election day is as things stand right now?
I think it's enormous. I think when you look at the fact that in 2012, an incredibly exciting presidential election, we had less than 59% of eligible voters come out to vote. And that's before a lot of the more recent restrictive voting provisions have come into place. And I think it's an enormous problem. Students are in class. Workers have to be on the job. I think keeping election days in the middle of the week is a huge obstacle to high turnout.
We'll get into the idea of either moving Election Day or making it a holiday in just a bit. But in the meantime, you're working, I mentioned, this election rave campaign. You're working to get schools, mostly law colleges, I think, to give people the day off. You're hoping workplaces will follow suit. What are you looking for people to do to make voting day a little easier to access?
That's exactly right. I think that law schools and colleges are the lowest hanging fruit. These are institutions that are espousing the importance of democracy and of participation, but at the same time are keeping their professors and their students from actually playing a part in it. So we think this is the great opportunity to really raise the bar and have these institutions show private employers and the government that it's possible that you can make one Tuesday every 2 to 4 years really special. And I think the dividends will pay off.
And when you say participating in Election Day, you're talking about voting, but not just voting. You're hoping people get more involved in different ways. Can you talk about that?
That's exactly right. I think it's incredibly important, especially when you're looking at the community of law professors and law students and lawyers, that they take this day, one day again, out of every 2 or 4 years, to give back and to go work at the polls. I've worked at polls the last few elections, and the people who sacrifice that time to go and make sure the process works smoothly are giving it their all, but there just aren't enough of them. And whether it's concerns with voter fraud or long lines that deter people who are just too busy to wait 2 or 3 hours to vote, having law students and professors and all other people volunteer half, couple hours of their time on election day could eliminate those problems overnight.
Do you think we as a society, Bo, take civic participation, especially in the form of voting and election day, seriously enough these days?
I don't think so. Again, I think the numbers speak for themselves, and I think I'm sure there are a lot of folks who would love to go out and cast their ballots, but they're working two jobs. They have kids at home who they need to take care of, and you know, going and casting a ballot just doesn't seem to be the top priority. I think that by making it a federal holiday, by a bunch of employers, schools canceling their obligations, I think it sends a message that voting is important, and I think that will empower a lot of people who maybe didn't have the flexibility to do it before or maybe didn't really see the impetus to voting. I think it'll get them out to the polls in droves.
Talking to Bo Tremeteer from the Northwestern Law Review. I've got a piece he wrote on the Central Time Facebook page on Election Day and how to fix it, how to make it more accessible for voters. You can join in, by the way, at 800-642-1234. Okay, Bo, here we are. We've got voting day on a weekday, Tuesday, nothing particularly special about it. How did we get here? Why did we end up with Tuesday in the first place?
I think we have to look back to the 1840s is when we started this tradition, and that's when Congress took a look at all the states who at that time had been setting election days any day of the week over about a 6-week span in late fall. And they said, what's the one day that we could make election day happen? And they picked Tuesday. Wednesdays were market days. Most folks back then were farmers. The weekends were dedicated to attending church and other worship. And so when most of these farmers had to travel 10, 12, 14 hours from their farm to the county seat, Tuesday was the only day that didn't interfere with worship and the market. And you know, fast forward 180 years later, and we haven't changed it, even though clearly most of us aren't following that schedule.
Well, let's look at a couple options for changing it for our schedule. Now, one thing people have floated, I think this is in your piece, the idea of moving it not on Tuesday, maybe on Saturday or Sunday when fewer people are at work, when virtually no one is at school. What would be the advantages there?
I think you just hit them. I think that we have fewer obstacles in the way. And of course, you know, there are plenty of people who work on weekends, and it's going to be a challenge for them as well. But I think that moving to the weekends gets rid of a lot of obstacles, especially for students and for young voters who are the least likely to show up. I think in 2014, we had less than 30% of voters under the age of 44 come to the polls. I think that when you move it to a weekend and you get rid of those big commitments, you empower people to come out to the polls. I think by also having on the weekends, it gives a chance for some creativity and creating other programs to ensure that people who do have to work on weekends have a chance to come as well. And most importantly, it's a statement. It's a statement of our values that Election Day is special. It's not just an ordinary Tuesday. And I think that that's missed right now by just going about our daily life on the November 8th.
And what would be the advantage of going for Election Day as a national holiday, whether it's on a weekend or a weekday?
To be frank, I don't think there's much of a difference. I think it really comes down to eliminating people's obstacles. And I think this speaks to why it would be great if Congress took this up and actually gave it some serious consideration. I think these are the sorts of questions that congressional hearings are best suited for conducting studies to investigate which option would support more workers, which option would support more families. And I think that Congress, when it sets its mind to something, can do amazing things. And I think that they could, you know, quite easily craft a fix here that would empower tens, if not hundreds of millions of Americans and really make this a truly participatory democracy.
another option some states have worked with, and there's been some pushback and back and forth, is, well, if the day is hard to vote on, we'll make early voting more accessible to people. Absentee, online, people have been talking about for a while. Do you see a workarounds like that, even if we're stuck for a while with Tuesday?
I think they can be a step in the right direction, but I think they don't get to the core issue of sending the message that voting matters. I think it's great to lower all of those burdens, but when if we were to set aside one day when we as a nation were to come together and choose how we are to govern ourselves, that's an incredibly powerful thing. And I think that when you open up early voting and do these other things, again, those are great steps, but you don't send that message to people. You don't have it reverberate through hundreds of millions of homes in the way that a collective commitment to a single day of voting would.
Some countries, I think Brazil, Australia, have some form of mandatory voting, taking things a little further, I guess. What would you think about that approach?
I think we should have everything on the table. I know the president has kicked around that idea before, and I think that as things stand, it might not necessarily comport with the Constitution as written, but I think that we should be willing to consider anything that increases participation, that gets everyone in the game, ensures that everyone has a voice.
Let's bring on a caller now. We've got Leah on the line in La Crosse. Leah, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What do you think?
I don't agree with having it a federal holiday. Moving it to a weekend would be great. I heard him comment and say something like, for mothers or for parents, it's a little of an inconvenience. You want to take care of the kids and stuff like that. And just for me, you know, I'm a student and I also work 3 part-time jobs. And that means that a federal holiday means that I have to take 8 hours on my day and not get paid to vote instead of taking the hour off or trying to make different arrangements. And I think it's kind of forcing my hand and a lot of single mothers' hand as well.
Leah, thanks, but you'd be up for a weekend, though, you're saying.
Yes.
Leah, thanks a lot for that call. Bo, I mean, any option here is going to be difficult maybe for somebody that is not difficult for now. There's going to be unintended consequences.
Most certainly, and I think that's exactly why Congress needs to step up to the table and actually look at this and figure out what solution is the best for the most number of people. And I think that right now we have, you know, hundreds of millions of people, 100 million of people who aren't having their voice heard, and that, you know, by definition, we're not hearing from them because they're not showing up to vote. And I think we need to think about that reality, but also, of course, keep in mind what effects any of these changes would have, and hopefully find a solution that minimizes the collateral inconveniences to people like Leah.
We're talking to Bo Tremeteer. He's the editor-in-chief of the Northwestern Law Review. He's involved in the Election Rave campaign. He's talking with us now about how best to encourage people to vote. He says one idea maybe to get people to the polls, forget this Tuesday election as it stands now, either move elections to the weekend or explore making Election Day some kind of national holiday.
And we want to hear from you. Do you think having Election Day on a Tuesday creates barriers for people to vote? Do you think you'd be more likely to vote if Election Day was a national holiday or on a weekend? Give us a call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can leave a comment on the Central Time Facebook page. As always, you can also email your thoughts to talk@WPR.org.
We're continuing our conversation about Election Day and how best to get people out to the polls. Bo Tremeteer is with us. He's editor-in-chief of the Northwestern Law Review. He's involved with the Election Rave campaign, which is advocating for shifting Election Day to a day of the week that's more convenient to voters or making it a national holiday.
And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. How would you feel if Election Day moved from a Tuesday to a Saturday? Do you find that getting time off work makes it difficult to head to the polls? Give us a call at 800-642-1234 or leave your comment on the Central Time Facebook page.
We'll go back to our callers now. We have Jim on the line in Rice Lake. Jim, hi.
Good afternoon. I mean, the government allows us several months to file our taxes, which we're required to do so legally. What is wrong with voter week? From Monday to Sunday, we could have a chance at our convenience to vote to ensure a full participatory democracy And does your guest have an opinion that the truth be told that there is one party that benefits from lower turnout and politically always seeks to ensure that? I look forward to his answer. Thank you.
Jim, thanks for the call. Let's take that in 2 points. First, forget Election Day. Make it, Jim Sangbo, an election week. Would there be something to be said? It would take some logistics, I guess, more volunteers at the polls, but would that be an idea worth exploring?
It's most certainly a step in the right direction. I think that, again, that sets a statement that, that voting matters. It increases opportunities for people who might have a really busy Tuesday. I think that that would be a big improvement over where we are now.
And Jim, wondering if there is a partisan advantage for one party or the other making it easier or harder to vote. Is that something that you're looking at, Bo? Is something you'd want to weigh in on?
We're a nonpartisan effort. We believe that increased participation is good for everyone, and I don't think there's any, there's no partisan motive for what we're looking to do, and I think that increased awareness of our electoral process benefits all.
Thanks for the call, Jim. We'll go next to Matt with us in Madison. Matt, hi.
Hi, how you doing?
Good. What do you think?
I'd like to see a longer voting day. You have multiple working shifts, and right now I work 10-hour days and have an hour and a half commute each way. So being able to get to the polls at a reasonable time is just not, doesn't work very well. I'd like to see, you know, maybe a longer day if a holiday isn't an option, then just extend hours.
Matt, thanks for the call. Yeah, eight to eight here today. And 7 to 8. Bo, thanks a lot for that call, Matt. Bo, longer voting hours he's calling for.
Again, a step in the right direction. I think that when you do that, you will come across the challenge of, as you noted earlier, needing more volunteers at the polls. And I think you'll need to ensure that folks have time to dedicate their day to helping those with long shifts, whether the days are canceled or not, from getting on. So, I think that that's one of those incremental changes, just like having law schools and colleges cancel classes, that takes us in the right direction. Congress isn't going to make this change on their own. They're not going to do it overnight. I think it takes grassroots efforts, a school at a time, a state at a time, to get them to see the importance of changes like these.
We'll go back to our callers. Dee is on the line in Green Bay. Dee, hi.
Hi. I'm calling because I'm on the way to the poll right now. I was able to get off of work early today. I had to stop at the grocery store. I'll be taking some of my groceries in with me. The most convenient way and the way to get people to vote is to do it online.
Dee, thanks for the call. Take your dairy to vote day, I guess. Bo, but she's saying online voting would be a more of a benefit to her.
I think it's something to consider, but I think we also need to, again, it should be one of the options on the table when Congress takes a serious look at this. But I think also it doesn't get to the heart of the problem that we have not made a statement as a nation that participation matters. I think you have in a lot of states with early voting, you have something equivalent to online voting in terms of the same level of convenience, but we still see participation rates that are quite low. I think that coming together around a single day or even or a week makes a statement to people that this is something we all have an obligation to do. I wouldn't shy away from considering online voting if we knew it could be safe and secure. But again, I don't think that fully solves all of our problems.
Tom on Facebook writes, it needs to be a well-publicized holiday. The primary needs to be moved back to September so the student and vacation vote is not lost. 16% turnout should not be a deciding vote. And Bo, just to let you know what's going on in Wisconsin today, is primary election day. That's been an argument, people saying, because it's in the summer, you don't get that student vote. People are on vacation. Predicted today 16% or so voter turnout. What do you think about the timing of elections? Not that big ticket one in November, but those primaries that can fall in the summer.
I think that matters a lot as well. I think it's important to have as many people as possible having a say into who our candidates are and who our elected officials are. I think that if the data proved that you had people more prone to be out of town and out of state in August than they would be in September, and then sure, it makes sense to move that in September. I think the focus needs to be stripping away politics, sitting back and looking at what changes increase the number of people who set foot in polling stations whenever it is that we open them up. And I think that those options need to be on the table, and I see no reason why to wait any longer.
Talking to Bo Tremeteer about voting day, he says our current system of election day on a normal work and school day Tuesday isn't getting the turnout we need, isn't getting the civic participation we need. Looking at the idea of maybe making it a national holiday or moving it to weekend, some way to get more people access to the polls. Back to our callers now with George in La Crosse. George, hi.
Hi, this is George. I'm from La Crosse. And I agree wholeheartedly that we need to do something different than just one day. You know, two or three days of voting would be much better than just one day, you know, from 7 to 8.
George, thanks a lot for that call. And Bo, that's the second person looking for more days of voting. You're hoping that somebody, though, Bo, starts the discussion to do something different than what we're doing now. Who would need to get that started?
I think everyone who's listening can. I think the power of writing to your congressman is something that maybe some of us have forgotten. It can be an incredibly powerful tool to remind them that you care. You could go online, www.electionrave.com, and reach out to us and let you know how you think we can do a better job of promoting these ideas. I think this isn't going to happen unless all of us as ordinary voters and you know, non-voters stand up and make our voice heard.
Thanks for the call, George. We've got Judy on the line with us now in Mount Sterling. Judy, hi.
Hi. I have some things to say. Number one, you mentioned that our election poll workers are volunteers. I take issue with that. They're not volunteers. They're paid. If we had 6 or 7 days of voting in my small community, it would break our budget. That's one. The other thing is, what about primaries? Is that going to be a holiday, too? And number three, I think people are making a statement by staying away.
Judy, thanks a lot for the call, and thank you for correcting me. Not volunteers. They are compensated for working at the poll, so my mistake there. But Bo, she's saying we couldn't afford to have expanded hours because we're paying people and keeping those sites open in more days. And the people who aren't showing up at the polls, they're making a statement. All the changes in the world won't get them, maybe, to the polls.
I think you do have a lot of people who spend time at the polls on election day, election monitors and other poll watchers who are doing it without making a dime. And I think that those are people that are important to not forget. I also think that if we had election day as a holiday, you'd have more people who could afford to take the day off, more, for instance, attorneys and people who are trained in the law who would be able to take that time and maybe wouldn't need any compensation to go and help out at the polls, and it could even be better for local municipalities and their budgets. And I think that it's the notion that not showing up is making a statement. It certainly is, and it's I've heard it loud and clear, and that's the motivation for me to want to play my part in this effort and try and find a way to engage with those tens of millions of Americans who don't feel that anyone is representing their voice and are so discouraged with our political system that they stay away entirely. I think that statement is, been heard loud and clear by many of us.
Bo, thanks a lot for joining us today.
It's a pleasure. Thank you.
That's Bo Tremeteer, editor-in-chief of the Northwestern Law Review. He's involved with the Election Rave campaign. He wrote a piece in The Hill calling for making Election Day a national holiday in order to allow more people to vote. The Election Rave campaign has been working with campuses nationwide in order to make it easier for students to vote. We've got a link to his piece, by the way, on the Central Time Facebook page.